Here we are with another episode of How to Be Tom Shalhoub. I'm going to add Robbie to the podcast. There he is, Robbie the Fire Bernstein. And what is that? What's your title there? The Cock King.
That's right, Robbie the Fire, King of the Cocks, Lord of the Sandwiches.
Okay. Hello.
How to Be Tom Shalhoub. Starring Tom Shalhoub. You know, not everybody wants to be Tom Shalhoub. But for those people who do, I guess this podcast is for them. I mean, you got to model yourself after someone, right? Might as well be me, Tom Shalhoub.
I know, I don't really understand the sandwich thing, because sometimes if you post something, someone will say, you know, how about sandwiches? And you say, you know, oh, I abhor them with all my heart. I don't know what the joke is, really, but you either love or hate sandwiches. I don't know which one it is.
Oh, I love sandwiches. I think you're coming out on anti-sandwiches. You're a thin man. I understand it. You seem health conscious, but no, I'm a fat Jewish guy. I love my sandwiches.
Yeah, no, I used to be more of a sandwich guy. I was known for walking around with bologna sandwiches in my backpack. And
you were doing it wrong. You were already bologna? Are you, come on, get out of here.
Wait.
That's like the lowest grade sandwich. Were you coming out of prison?
My sandwich philosophy is this. Okay. I believe that to me, the ideal sandwich is two pieces of bread with one item in between them. I don't put salad in my sandwiches. I'm, you know, like a slice of meatloaf on two slices of white bread. That would be a great sandwich. I used to like bologna on white with mayo, maybe, you know, but essentially I like what is the original meaning of the sandwich, you know, was somebody stuck something in between a piece of bread.
You're a little bit older than me, so I hate to tell you that you lived your entire life wrong. I hate to say that. I don't know you that well. I don't know the rest of your life, but just based off of this, it seems to me like you've done quite a few things. And I'd be happy to spend a day with you and coach you through a lot of things, because if you've messed up on something as simple as sandwiches in such a profound way, there must be some other simple things that could bring you joy. No, but I can appreciate a simpler sandwich. I can appreciate where you're coming from.
Yeah.
Where you're like, I don't like this thing overdone. I think a sandwich should be able to, you should be able to eat a sandwich in the car. If there's too much coming and going out of it, that it's getting all over you, that's too much sandwich. But
yeah, I don't like things squeezing out the sides.
So I respect where you're coming from. And I respect when you're like, listen, I just want like my turkey and mustard or something.
Yeah.
But with that said, the sandwich is all about bringing the different elements together, containing it so you can have it all in one bite. So if you're just committed to just bologna without some condiment or tomato to balance that out, I just feel like you've missed the craftsmanship and the artistry.
Yeah, I did have a great sandwich the other day at a place that I can't think of the name of it. Maybe you would know. It's an old Italian deli. It was on 45th Street and it's closed. You know, I went there, I got a sandwich, and it was one of these wonderful Italian sandwiches, and it had the red peppers on it and all the wonderful, he put oil on it. Very, very good. And I did it as a Fox News segment, actually. I went out and I said, let's get a sandwich, you know? And so we did it, and it was just beautiful. But then I went back and the place was closed, because those kind of places cannot survive in New York anymore.
Well, the upper 50 area is particularly difficult to be like a corner deli.
Yeah.
I mean, you still go down to East Village or Washington Heights. You got delis all over the place. But that like 42nd Street to 55th, that's rich man's territory.
Yeah. What about this? It's something I only discovered a few years ago, and I didn't know it existed. It's called a chopped. What is it? A chopped ham?
Chopped cheese?
Chopped cheese.
Yeah,
chopped cheese.
Sandwich.
You know, and I didn't know what it was, and they were all razzing me because I was in the, you know, in the Heights, because I was living in Riverdale, and I would go down to the Heights sometimes. You know, I always thought that was all part of my neighborhood. But when I got there and I didn't know what a chopped cheese was, they were like, "You're not even, don't even pretend you're from anywhere, because you don't know what a chopped cheese is." And it's really a downscale kind of sandwich, but they take a lot of pride in it.
The chopped cheese is, I don't eat cheese anymore. But the chopped cheese is a good sandwich, because I like, even I'm a lazy cook. I'm a single person. I cook my own meals. And I find I won't eat a chopped cheese because I don't eat cheese. But if you ever just open up a ground, like a pack of ground beef, you just throw it into a pan and you just chop it up and cook it. I like my burgers a little bit more well done. You can season the hell out of that. It's kind of like the poor man's burger. So the chopped cheese might be one of the quickest, easiest, and most delicious sandwiches you can make, because you're just crushing up a hamburger patty. So you got well-done meat. You season the hell out of it. Then it's like, you know, loaded with the cheese on top of it. It's a simple sandwich. You can cook it in 2 minutes, and it's you're not going to go wrong with the chopped cheese.
Yeah, although in the Heights, they take an absurd amount of pride in it, as if it's not a... It's a poor man's sandwich. I mean, it's something that a guy would make after school, you know, like it's not sophisticated, but they act like it is.
Right. Well, put it this way. It's such an easy thing to do. Even I can make it in my kitchen. Like that's how far down the five-star cuisine we are when you get to there. But people are obsessed with mac and cheese. They're obsessed with their grilled cheese sandwiches. So I think it's like it's an easy staple.
Yeah. Well, so that's your thing. That's what the sandwich is. One of my goals today in talking with you was to talk about, you know, because you can always talk. I'll say I'm an occasional listener of Part of the Problem. You do how many? Nice. 3 shows a week?
Yeah. And then I got my own podcast, Run Your Mouth. I do another 2 or 3 times a week. So I talk a lot.
Right. So what's it called? Run Your Mouth?
Run Your Mouth podcast. Yeah.
And is that part of Gas Digital?
No, that's just my own solo operation. Do it right here from my living room.
Oh, great. Okay. So you got the Part of the Problem, and you are co-host. Would you say co-host or sidekick with...
Either one's cool. I think co-host makes me sound a little more esteemed, but sidekick's cool also.
I know. Yeah. I didn't want to say...
No, it's all good.
Sidekick is to me, a reputable place to be.
Right.
And I've done sidekicking with Gutfeld. I was for years essentially the opening act for Gaffigan. And so I consider myself his sidekick, or as I would say, third wheel sometimes, because I would be with he and his wife were, you know, this team, and I would be
brutal
on the side, you know. Yeah. But, you know, I would say so third wheel. And I did for a while the third wheel podcast where I would, interview them and kind of joke that I was a third wheel in their marriage on the tour and things like that. But so with Dave Smith is Part of the Problem. Okay. And did you start with that one, or was it kind of the Dave Smith podcast and then you kind of invaded it?
I wish I could take credit for the name or anything to do with the show. I got real lucky. Me and Dave are friends, and he was doing the podcast. I want to say I would eyeball that the podcast is going 9 years, and he did the first 4 years without me or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And I was lucky because I was not as good at podcasting back then. So it was cool that I was friends with him and he kind of threw me on. And if you go back and watch the old episodes, if you guys think I don't talk now, I used to really just sit there and nod.
Yeah. Well, you would kind of chime in, but then that's the way a lot of radio relationships start. You know, you get someone who's either a producer and they're not really an on-air person, but they have to talk to the host, and then they end up being part of the show. Right. And that's kind of the way you've done it with Dave. And now it's really a co-host situation where you kind of bounce off each other. Right.
It's a little different now because I dictate more of the topic. So sometimes the show is steered a little bit more towards my interest and things that I have what to say about.
Yeah.
But there's still the occasional episode where, you know, Dave's knowledge on certain topics dwarfs mine by a long shot. And so sometimes it's incredible because I feel like I get the front row seat and he's just going. So it's like watching a brilliant solo guitar player. I can just sit back and just be like, I don't even know how he knows all this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, would you say that you're a producer of the show? Is that, you know, if you decide the topics and
plan
the show?
If I had to apply somewhere and put together my resume, I think I'd throw that down. But I mean, me and Dave basically produce the show. It's kind of, we spitball topics back and forth via text, and then we kind of, you know, pick from our pile of topics and game plan ahead of time.
Yeah. So let's kind of talk about the, I'll first introduce it by talking about what I would do in my career, because I kind of want to talk about how you're making it all happen, you know, in the business, but I don't want to, you know, ask too many questions that you're like, oh, I don't want to talk about how much money I make or what I do. But I'll tell you that, you know, I'm fascinated by the way people put it together. Right now I'm working for Fox News, so I have a steady job, but for years I was always putting it together. So in the 90s, I would start doing stand-up and I was working waiting tables and then doing temp jobs. And I was trying to do all these, you know, kind of support jobs as I did stand-up. Then I started doing commercials and I was able to make a living that way. And then I would stop doing the road gigs. Like a lot of my comedian friends were surviving on the road because you can't make a living in New York City, you know, because the pay was so low. So I would, at first, I'm doing road gigs. Oh, you know, this room in Jersey pays $300, so I'm going to go do that one, you know. Then when I started getting into the advertising, commercials were the way I made it happen. That was my living. And then I could do the spots in New York, and I wasn't a road warrior, basically just stick around trying to be where the action is in New York, you know, ready for opportunities, but making my living doing advertising. And then after I got married, you know, I kind of sucked it up. Jim and I were peers. Gaffigan and I started together. And so I was never like, oh, I don't want to open for Jim, even though his career is like reaching big heights. I didn't want to be his opener because I was like his friend, you know? And then after a while, he was so big, I was like, I better jump on this train now, you know? So the opportunity came up and I started touring with him. Then I wasn't making a living in advertising. I was making a living in stand-up, but it was really on the road. So I was playing these nice gigs, but I was still an opening act. Eventually, I was able to get the gig with Gutfeld and get hired by Fox News. So, you know, that's the way I've been putting it all together. And now I'm still kind of a sidekick for Greg. Essentially, I'm his opening act when we play these big theaters, just like I used to do with Gaffigan. And I just got off the road. I was in Texas doing my own gig. So it's like sometimes I play the smaller rooms. I played Hyenas, and then I played a theater in Houston. And, you know, I can make more money with Greg playing these big theaters, but I'd rather do my own, ideally, because that's what I'm always working toward, is being my own guy, you know? So you're similarly, you're kind of working, you know, you work with Dave, you do your own shows. I hear on the part of the problem, you'll say, oh, come see me and Dave. We're going to go to Europe. Like, you're going to go to Scotland, right?
Yeah, we're doing like 6 days in Europe starting this Thursday, which is pretty damn cool.
Yeah. So you guys, you got a lot of listeners to Part of the Problem, probably more than your podcast. It's a smaller operation, right?
Yeah, okay, for sure.
So you're trying to leverage that audience for Part of the Problem to come out and see you and Dave. And also you'll say, hey, come see me at, you know, Uncle Vinny's or wherever you're playing to do your kind of solo gigs, right?
Yeah. So I work a lot of jobs at the moment, and luckily I'm still single, so I can pull that off. But no, I do a really weird thing. So I'm basically every other weekend. Dave usually does 2 weekends a month, so I'll do those weekends with Dave. And similar to you, those are much bigger shows, and they're more lucrative than my my solo operations.
Yeah.
But I probably do the weirdest thing in all of comedy, which is all summer I do this thing called Summer Porch Tour. And I gig from fans' backyard. So I put it out there in March where
you know
I say,
what? I know about Summer Porch Tour, and I didn't know it was you. Like,
yeah,
I've seen, you know, the funny thing is, I hear you on Dave's show. And then Summer Porch Tour was something I saw through Facebook or something. And I went to, and I said, oh, this is a great idea, this dude, you know, but I didn't pay attention to who was doing it. But I saw you tell a couple of jokes in somebody's, you know, backyard or something. And isn't it funny? I didn't know that you two were the same people.
That's great. My favorite thing is there's so many people that listen to the podcast and then they see me for the first time and they go, I never thought you would have looked like that.
And exactly.
I would love to get a sketch artist to get the drawing, because everyone's got a different vision. Some people are like, you're so much shorter than I expected. Other people are like, oh, you're not nearly as fat as I expected. Everyone's got their own vision of, you know, what they think I'm supposed to look like in their head. So I actually love that. I love when people are like surprised to put it together and go, oh, I didn't even realize that was you.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I did, I must have done 30 gigs this summer. It was crazy. It was like, you know, I would play someone's backyard in Denver, get on a plane the next day to, you know, Michigan. I was planning routes. It was wild.
Yeah. I mean, that's great. So you've got, like you just said, I do a lot of jobs. So you're doing, but are they all in showbiz or do
so
you?
So I have, so basically, firstly, I got the two podcasts and luckily, you know, after 5 years, they'll start, those are actually making money, mm-hmm. which was, that was a long road to get there. Stand up, I did more gigs this past year on the road than, I mean, the income increase in stand up from, like, if I were to, like, if you were looking at, like, a stock chart of the last 3 years,
yeah,
the growth is unbelievable, particularly this past year, because I've been on the road nearly every weekend, which is new. And sometimes it's, like, multiple cities in a weekend. On top of that, I still have the backdrop of I used to do all the ad sales at Gas Digital.
Yeah.
I no longer do that, but behind the scenes, I'd still manage some of the bigger accounts. And sometimes like I just freelance in place. I mean, through Gas Digital, but I'll play some pretty big, ad deals on, you know, podcasts that aren't even affiliated with the network.
Wow. So that's good. I might want to go into that direction and, because I want to know about that, how it all, I always want to know how, Gas Digital, I don't know how these podcast operations work. You know, they all seem quite successful. I don't mean they're not all successful, but right. I think Gas Digital is one of the bigger ones, is it not?
Well, I mean, it's incredible what Lewis and Ralph have managed to put together. And it's they're a good team, and they've managed to attract really good support staff. So yeah, I mean, they just put out those half hour specials. They've got some big shows on the network. They've had some big launches along the way. And so, yeah, they got a pretty established machine going at this point.
Yeah. So let's talk about the ad sales. You don't have to get into numbers.
Sure.
But it's, for instance, let's just take one product off of your, you and Dave's podcast, you know, like the curling machine that uses resistance bands, right?
Sure. Wow, you know, you're really like, listening to the show. That one's actually not mine, but God bless. Listening to the ads, too.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I just usually podcast. I'm perfect for the podcast audience because I put it on and I'm not going to fast forward because I'm in the car usually when I listen to it.
Right.
So I've just heard the ads. And so there's an exercise machine that's kind of like a curling bar, but instead of weights, you have resistance bands on it.
Right.
So you can do curls and you can, I'm assuming, do all sorts of, you know, other exercises. And so, you know, Dave is like, buy this thing, buy it now, you know, and put Gas Digital in the thing and get money. So is that I don't know if you know if you can reveal this, but those kind of advertisers, are they, you know, do they, is it a revenue deal where you just like make a percentage of sales, or do they, you know, is it some combination? How do you get these clients?
So now you're getting the sales guy out of me. We do not take affiliate deals. I will hang up the phone on people if they start asking for affiliate deals. We're CPM rate only. And, you know, I mean,
what's that mean? CPM?
Now we're getting into the weeds.
I mean, people like this though. I mean, I don't know how this works.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a technical term for cost per mile, but essentially you pay per 1,000 downloads. So just to keep it simple, a show with 10,000 downloads an episode is going to cost less than a show with 100,000 downloads an episode, because you're reaching a bigger audience, you're getting more exposure, you're going to see more sales. Very similar to TV ratings.
Yeah. And so there are people who want to do the affiliate, meaning like, you know, it's like click this link and you'll only make it if somebody buys the product. But no, you take deals where they're going to pay you for airtime because you have that many listeners.
Exactly. Well, here's the thing with the affiliate deals. If you're an advertiser, it's always in your interest to take an affiliate deal because, you know, there's no risk to you.
Yeah.
There's zero risk. Hey, that guy's going to plug. If I make money, great. I'll pay a percentage. The problem for podcasts when it comes to affiliate deals is that, for one, you're relying on that company and their tracking, and they're not going to track every single sale. So they're completely discounting any branding that they will get or sales that come down the road.
Yeah.
And they know that, which is partly why they push for the affiliate deals. And then you're also relying on their tracking in terms of self-reporting of how the sales are actually doing to be paying you out your percentage.
Yeah.
And aside from all that, I think with a lot of companies, they can make a lot more money with the CPM deals, but it's more, hey, this is what it costs us to put our show together. Here's the rates by which we see advertisers are making money. So here's what's good, you know, and we'll take test runs. We want advertisers to make money, but we don't want to have to wait 6 months for you to process what you think you made off of us to then cut us a check. That just doesn't really work for the artists. And the way you bully the people out of requesting the affiliate deals is you can let them know, and this is true, there's no sizable shows that are taking it. So they're going to lose a lot of time basically trying to convince podcast hosts that it's worthwhile, as opposed to just spend the money, get the exposure, see the results, plan from there. But at least you're moving the ball forward.
Yeah. So you're essentially saving, you're saying like, I'm going to reject you, but I'm saving you time for you getting rejected.
I'm telling you, if you wanted to run an affiliate deal, you're going to have to hire someone full time to be talking to like all of these podcasts and then trying to figure out when they're not running their ads.
Yeah.
And you're not going to get any sizable podcasts that want to do it. You're not going to get real professionals who will take the affiliate deals. So you're literally just wasting your time.
Yeah. Do you know if there's anybody, I mean, does anyone do stand-up now without doing podcasts? Is it a viable way to get into the business?
It's so rare. It's so rare because even look at all the things that existed when you were coming up that could have pushed you over. What was there? There was, I guess, you could have gotten on Comedy Central and gotten exposure.
TV spots. Yeah, just TV spots.
TV spots, right?
Yeah.
I mean, even now, if you got on, I mean, Letterman doesn't exist. Let's say Jimmy Fallon. Let's say you got on Jimmy Fallon show 5 times a year. No one's ever done the Tonight Show 5 times in a year. Do you think you'd be selling comedy club tickets? Not really. I mean, the comedy clubs might book you because they can market, oh my God, this is the one guy who does Fallon 5 times a year. Truthfully, people are probably pushing more tickets off of Gutfeld. I bet if you were getting on Gutfeld once a month, you could move tickets on the road. But how many comics do you guys have panel on a month?
I mean, it's basically, you got to think of, there's only one comic on the show at a time.
Right.
And so even the guys who are really, you know, bugging Greg for more and more spots, they're probably on once a week. So, you know,
so there you have it. You got a show with 5 comics that are getting on once a week. So that's one TV outlet that 5 comics can be getting on the road from.
Yeah.
Outside of that, what other opportunities exist unless you kind of are grinding your own podcast? And if you look at most of the, like, if you just looked at the comedy club rosters of look at the improvs or the clubs that you're going to, and you look at the other headliners, I can tell you it's all people who are either have current hit podcasts or it's TV people from, it's Rob Schneider. It's people from like 20 years ago that hit through like your SNLs or, you know, having a sitcom or whatever else.
Yeah. I mean, now when I'm doing gigs on my own, it's kind of like almost a separate deal. I mean, it's not a separate deal because if it's a theater, then it's some kind of deal with the booker and they try to, you know, work it out, and I'll do promotion and they do their promotion, whatever they do. But with a comedy club, it's kind of like, you know, in the old days you had these bookers who they knew what headliners they could rely on, and they would just call the clubs and they would kind of just fill up the book that way. Now these clubs are looking for people to do these kind of like special shows. And that's what I want to do, because my audience is older, because it's the Fox News audience. So I'm doing these 4 o'clock shows now, these matinees. And, you know, people love it. They, San Francisco, nobody even, the Fox News people, they don't even want to go into San Francisco, but they don't want to go to the city. You know, they're like, why are you playing in the city? Come out where we are, you know?
Right.
But if I'm going to play the city, if I play the Punchline in San Francisco, they don't want to come see me at 8 o'clock. They want to come at 4 and they want to be home by like 7.
I mean, you got a great business model because the club probably doesn't have anything at 4. So that's a win, because you can't even get the Saturday spot at 4 o'clock because the headlining show of whoever they got for the weekend is not going to be till 6, 8, and 10. So that's a win for you.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're, you know, and other people, I'm convincing Greg. Greg's doing early shows now. Jamie Lissau does early shows because that's, you know, these audiences love it. I mean, they want to have dinner after the show and they want to have dinner at like 6:45.
Right. I personally hate early shows. I still find early shows are my kryptonite because I work a little bluer, and I find like your friendly 7 p.m. Above 50. I probably have 10 minutes that would work for your audience, but if I was trying to headline for your crowd, it would be 50-50. Half the time I would get them on board where like they would get it, and like the other half they'd be like, I don't know what just happened.
Yeah.
But Sundays I've started doing early shows because I find people like to drink on Sundays. So like when I do my porch tour in backyards, you know, Fridays and Saturdays, I'm like 8 or 9 o'clock PM.
Yeah.
But like a Sunday 5 PM afternoon drinking show, I'm finding those work great.
Yeah. I love this porch idea. So since I'm just figuring out that it's you, I kind of wanted to know more about it when I went on there, and I was like, oh, I gotta look that guy up and see what he's doing. So, so you came up with the idea, or did you just do a show in somebody's yard and you're like, oh, I gotta do this more often?
It started because I was, it started when I was just doing the podcast in year one. I want to say maybe I had like 700 or 800 listeners or something like that, but
that's a lot to me.
Hey, listen, you're a killer. You're gonna pick this thing up. I don't know where your numbers are now, but you'll see it grows. How long have you been doing this show for?
Well, I mean, I don't really, it just now, I did it early in the pandemic. I was doing the podcast and then I stopped, and you know, we can talk about that after, but I couldn't talk anymore. I was like, okay. I can't deal with any of these people. Yeah, yeah, I had no regard for any of it, so I couldn't even argue. I wasn't even going to talk about stupid like IFRs or like math. Okay. I was like, I cannot talk about this anymore. So I just stopped podcasting. I started watercolor painting, and I wouldn't look at the news. I couldn't deal with any of it.
I love that. That's great. That's a great way to. That's such a classy way, by the way, to turn off the universe is by watercoloring.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's this great guy on YouTube that I follow, and he. He's like, you know, he's not like Bob Ross, but he's right. He's just a cool watercolor guy.
Okay.
And James Gurney is his name, Gurney Studios. And he's great. And he will just, you can just paint along with him.
Okay. You're not selling this to me. I would hate this, but I love that to you, the cool watercolor guy. It's a different demo. I love it.
Yeah. but so I did a few episodes, and I've never been very ambitious with it because I used to do Fox News Radio, and then you know, they had a fairly big audience there. And then when I started podcasting, it's just been a hobby. So I'll do an episode, you know, I talk to people that are interesting, and then I put it up on Twitter and Facebook, and I see how many people listen to it. But it's never been that many, but you know, now that you're talking about like, you know, advertising and everything, I almost want to like, you know, I want to get into
it. It's getting the juices going of, oh my God, you can actually do well with this thing. Well, I started with the podcasting just because I felt like there were bits and topics that I wanted to get into that didn't really fit stand up. So I just started doing the podcast, and it was also a very smart strategic move for me because I noticed that I was not the most sociable of people, and I was a good joke writer. Like, I was very much like a stay in my lane kind of joke writer type of comic. Mm-hmm. And I saw that the market really insisted on you being good at the radio thing, which I was not. So I just decided, let's just get good at it. So I just started doing the podcast, and, you know, it started off as once a week, and now I do 3 times a week. But I definitely just kind of realized if you were trying to do stand-up comedy now, this was an important tool.
Yeah. And so, I mean, really 6 times a week, you're talking about 3 with Dave and 3 on
your own, basically.
Right?
Yeah. I do a lot of radio, but with the porch tour, what happened was I was doing the show. I was a little bit surprised by the amount of listeners, and I was curious to see if they were real people. And I'd moved to New York City. I was living in this tiny, I mean, I'd like that you've lived in New York as an upcoming guy. I'd like the tiniest room. And all of a sudden my career kind of changed from, I thought I would never be in the apartment doing spots every night. And then I was doing more podcasting. And so I was just kind of stuck in my tiny room. So I did as a joke. It started as a goof where I said, you invite me to your porch, I need to get out of my apartment, I will do an episode with you as my co-host just to get out of this apartment. And so year one, I did like 3 or 4 podcasts, literally from fans of my show's porch. It was like a weird bit, and they were weird episodes. And then year two, I was like, why don't we just try and do stand-up shows from people's yards? And by year three, it became that enough people were buying tickets at the local shows. I realized, oh, this might be viable even with flights involved. And now this past year was my 5th year. And I also figured out I have to stack weekends, like, because basically a flight to California, let's just say that costs you like $400.
Yeah.
Since you and an Oprah, 800 with hotel room, 1,000. So even 50 tickets at $20, you're now at break even. Right. So what typically happens if I don't stack shows is you're breaking even. But if I can do multiple shows in a region, so like, let's say I fly to California and then I drive to San Francisco and then I drive to San Antonio and then I drive to somewhere else and I hit 4 off of the $1,000 on flights.
Yeah.
You start making money on every gig because you're cutting down on the travel costs. So I start, that's why that took me a couple years to figure out that I had to stack like three cities into like a single weekend.
Yeah.
Cause that's the way I draw. I draw like maybe between at the moment, like 50 to 100 people in a city. So I'm like good for a one nighter, but that's also not with the club. It would be different, you know, maybe if the club was putting me up and pushing it. But anyways, I'm just like, let's just do it. That's just kind of my personality. And then also, I personally have done a good job of not waiting for opportunities or waiting for other people to wave a little wand and go, hey, you're good to go. Or here's an opportunity. Here you can be on TV. Yeah. I'm just, let's just do it and get better. So, you know, and I don't even think I had an hour to start. You know what I mean? That becomes a thing. It's like, oh, I got to write another 20 minutes. I have to go do an hour in this person's backyard. And then you listen back to the tape, you edit what's not working. So I find for me, it's just the drive of let's just do it. Let's just keep doing it. Let's just keep getting better. And then the porch tours became a real thrill because, listen, I love being in comedy clubs. It's so much easier for me. I just show up. I'm doing 25 minutes, 30 minutes before Dave. It's a packed house.
Yeah.
They're serving me drinks. They're giving me food. They're taking care of the hotels. Comedy clubs rule. In terms of like the aesthetic and some of the better clubs when they're packed and you're killing and everything's just working, it's the best. Porch tour is just so different in that like people show up, they bring their own lawn chairs, they bring their cooler of beer. I'm there. We hang out late. I usually do a live podcast, which is pretty loose and kind of sporadic. So it's a very different thing in that like the fans that do come out for it, it's kind of like a whole evening of just hanging out. It's a little bit more of like a scene.
And how do you get the porches? Do people say, hey, I want you on my porch?
So I put out the feelers. The logistics on it suck. I mean, it's funny to me how much work that I hate that I still have to do for myself and my career.
Yeah.
But basically what happens is I put it together January, February, March, and I just say, we're putting together porch tour. Email me if you got a porch. People will email me. And then I start mapping out routes based on like the porches. Now we're in year three. So I have like some very established and good markets where like I had a fan that literally I've had more than one fan actually build a stage for me in their backyard and invest in sound equipment. So like now we have almost like established outdoor theater spots for me and they're flex because some of these people's backyards, they could do 300 people. We're not at the moment. We're doing like 100, but so it's gotten easier now because like next year I now have to figure out how to have a new hour of material. But for next year, I can basically just flip the switch on of go, hey, we're doing all these spots again. But no, the logistics this past year, it's crazy. You gotta sift through all the emails. Then you got to call the people, kind of vet the property, vet if it's going to make sense, see if you can get a sound system out there and you just piece it together.
And when you're on the road, can you still do the podcast with Dave?
Yeah, I mean,
you just call in.
Yeah, basically. I mean, we're remote at the moment, even though he built a studio. So I think we're going to be in person in the near future. Which I will say that's cut down for me, probably in a good way, a little bit of the comedy party lifestyle is that I got to wake up in the morning and read the news.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it does change the dynamics of forcing me to be a bit of more of an adult.
But when you do the live, you said you did some live stream podcasts like on the porch show. What's your rig? Like what kind of equipment do you have to bring to do a live podcast?
I'm at a point now because I also, when me and Dave do road shows, we do live podcasts, which are great. I mean, you kind of seem to like talking the business side of it. The live podcasts are great. Firstly, I find they're a thrill because I get to write jokes on the, like, it's a little bit more what you guys do at Gutfeld. I get to read a news story, write a joke from that day, and then pretend like I was coming up with it on the spot. And when those land, I don't know, that to me is like that feels so good. And then it's also fun because Dave's really good at tagging my jokes. So sometimes I'll throw something out there and then he riffs on it. So the actual live podcasts are a lot of fun. I have a full rig at this point to record and produce those live shows. I mean, I can tell you the technicals on it. It's not a ton of equipment, but I have all the gear to do it.
Yeah. So it's like, you mean full rig, you know, some people don't know what this equipment is. Like I just have a little box here that I can plug two mics into and I plug it into my computer. And then the StreamYard does the rest. I mean, this is what's great about these services like StreamYard. You can just call into it, and I don't have to do any kind of like, whatever technical stuff you have to do. But you have what? You have like a little box?
So sometimes I travel. I got this little portable projector because I'll work off of I'll work with slides. I kind of do desk pieces where I'll even come up with jokes that are like in the graphics.
You're projecting.
Yeah.
You know, slides for the audience.
Yeah. Or sometimes like I'll be reacting to a clip, that kind of thing. I also find for me, I personally like working with slides because I find that if I didn't put the proof right in front of you of here's this from the Wall Street Journal and kind of source things from traditional sources, it sounds like I'm being a conspiracy lunatic. So I actually really do like to put the sources right in front of people because then I find that my perspective becomes a little bit more undeniable. Whereas I know for me as a consumer, if I was listening to the things I was saying and you didn't put me right in front of me, I would just go, that's not true. So I personally like, Dave doesn't use that at all, but I like the projector because I like to be able to throw the sources right in front of people. And then also I'll do like desk piece style stuff with jokes that are kind of photoshopped and that kind of stuff. But my rig is essentially, I travel with the projector and then I use a Zoom to record everything, but I like to use splitters. So I'll split feeds. Like what I do is basically I got a box, they're $30. It's probably the best piece of equipment for like for this type of stuff. And is this interesting? I mean, I'm happy.
Love this stuff. I got a Focusrite. It's Focusrite. I don't know if that's a similar
I know exactly the box like you have.
Bucks.
And it goes red if you're peeking and it hooks up to your computer. That's a pretty that's kind of, you've got the basic professional rig. When what I mean is like it's kind of the starter level, works perfectly. Like you got your traditional SM 45 or SM 38, whatever that is, but the traditional that's a good setup. SM 58. Got a good setup. So what I do is I'll travel with two Zooms. I'll take one Zoom and I'll plug it into the house board. And I have like a fancy cord to kind of remove hissing sounds.
Zoom. I get it. So the Zoom digital recorder. I was thinking Zoom, you know, like, the version of Zoom that people used to do teleconferencing.
Right.
You're talking about audio. So the Zoom just records the audio.
So I got the Zoom H6, right? And I got two of these. Yeah. So I'll take one and I'll plug it into the house board, which basically they'll have a line out, and I'll plug this into that and I'll record the board sound. And that's my backup. And if I want to record stand up, I'll point the shotgun mic at the crowd so I can get crowd laughter.
Yeah.
Then what I do from the stage so that I can control the sound is I'll split all the lines before it goes into the house board. So what I do is I have like a 1-2 splitter, right? Yeah. So I would take the house microphone and I'll unplug it from the wall and I'll plug it into my splitter. I'll take one cord and I'll go directly into where it was going before. And then I'll take another cord and I'll plug it into the Zoom. So now I've got a direct feed on my Zoom and I can control the sound. And I can do that for up till 4 microphones. And then what I also do is, because sometimes I'll man the board with my laptop to like play clips or that kind of stuff. So I'll do the exact same thing where I have a cord. And by the way, this might sound complicated. We're talking about a couple pieces of equipment. I can set up a live pod for 1,000 people literally in a half hour. But I just have a board, like a line, so I can split sound for my computer into the house system and then also record directly to the Zoom.
Yeah. No, it is. It's just that extra level of you need to get the sound from your mics out to the audience and into your recording equipment.
Yeah.
But you're not worried about video. You're just doing audio here then, right?
No, I run video too.
You do? Okay.
Yeah. So video, I got to step up my game because the problem I find recording in comedy clubs is that, listen, I mean, if you got a full production crew, you can do whatever.
Yeah.
Me as a single individual running around with Dave, tripods are not great in comedy clubs because if the comedy club is sold out, you got to take away seats for your tripod or you're not going to find a good sight line for them or you're nervous about like waitresses knocking them over.
Yeah.
Not to mention the fact that like, you know, I don't know, how many tripods are you even going to pack in a single, like, you can get $1,000 carbon fiber tripods, but what are you going to fit three in a bag type deal? And that's pretty expensive production at that point. What I do is I got these, like, I'm using a clamp right now, but essentially, and I got to buy more, like, I'll buy old phones that actually have very good cameras in it.
Yeah.
And then essentially I just clamp them, which just makes it very easy to get, like, close to the stage and get easier angles.
Yeah. And then, but if you have phones, they're what? Are they hardwired into the thing, or are they just...
So,
like,
I don't go, I'm not going live. You just in post, you just merge. Yeah, oh, yeah. You just merge sound with audio. And at least for part of the problem, we got a post-production team, so I don't have to deal with that.
Oh, okay. That's pretty good. Yeah. Because the... I never look at these videos, but a lot of people for the podcast, they do it on YouTube, or I just like audio. I like audio podcasts. That's the way I like to do it. That's my relationship with podcasting. But I mean, I guess some people like to watch TV. To me, podcasts are the thing that you do when you're not watching TV. It's for the train, it's for the car, whatever. So I like audio, but now that I'm podcasting, I'm doing it as video because I know there's a certain amount of people who want to watch it on Rumble or, you know, or Facebook or whatever.
I find what I like with the video, and particularly StreamYard for me, is I like to go live. Because one, with going live, that means I can't edit, and I just find that means I don't edit, which I used to get finicky with. And then the other thing is, with StreamYard, you can just go live to Twitter, Rumble, Odyssey, YouTube. You can just go live to all those places, and then you don't have to do the post-production of then going to all those places to actually put up the video. It just saves at least an hour of work, easy.
Yeah, I'll probably start doing that. I like the idea of doing live. I went live with Dr. Drew last week.
Fun.
Because he was there, and I was in, he was at Fox, so we just did it in my office.
Right.
But the I'm always nervous to go live because I think, I don't know, it's just not going to go well, and then it's like permanent. But once I get over that, I'll start going
I
live.
I found, for me, I mean, it's like stand-up. When you're four, you just do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, I used to edit my podcast pretty meticulously because I would do jokes, and I would just know that joke was bad. Like, the second I would say it for the first time, I'd just be like, that was a really bad joke. There was nothing funny about it. I didn't deliver it well, and I'd yank it out. And I'd be like, thank God no one will ever know that I thought that that was even funny and presented it. I find, for me, the live energy just changed the dynamic in that I don't fumble in the same way. I don't feel like I have to make edits in the same way. It just forces you to present it and know that you can't make edits, and so you just, it just works. I don't know.
Yeah, and the audience gives you, they know it's live, so they're
so you get a little leeway.
Yeah, doesn't, sometimes professionalism is overrated, because I like listening to, one of my favorite things is Twitter Spaces. I just open it up, and I hear people, you know, talking, and there's no stakes, because if you don't like it, you just, you know, click, you're done, you know?
Yeah, you're out. It's easy.
Yeah. So... we're probably going to leave this, but maybe before we leave, I thought I might do some COVID talk with you, but I was more fascinated by the business. That's more interesting to me at this point. And, but I'm going to ask you this about the COVID. I'm wondering what you think, cause you were pretty good on COVID from the beginning. You didn't fall for any of the nonsense. And, you know, obviously some people did, Dave as well. Dave was always very good, on COVID, but there was, most people were swept up in a lot of foolishness, and you couldn't really talk to them. Did you find the libertarian world kind of let you down? I don't want to pick on the guys from Reason Magazine, but let's pick on the guys from Reason Magazine. Like, during COVID, like I said, I kind of tuned out and I didn't want to see anything, but every once in a while I would go on and say, I'm not going to look at this nonsense on any of these mainstream sites, but let me go on to Reason. Maybe they have something. But Reason, I thought that their headlines every single day on their website should have been, you know, worst civil liberties abuses continue, you know, worst in U.S. history. But I would go on there and, there'd be articles about the IFR of COVID. Maybe COVID's IFR is less than we thought. It's like, where were the libertarians during COVID? Did you feel that?
Reason was not my introduction to libertarianism.
Yeah.
And so to me, they're kind of the irrelevant old guy with bad opinions.
Some of the guys in there, I like Nick. Do you know Nick?
So I've hung out with Nick a couple times years ago when I was, and he couldn't have been nicer or a cooler person. So in terms of like personal relationship with Nick, not that I've hung out with him recently, but he's been fascinating to talk to, bright guy, and he couldn't have been nicer to me on a personal level. I don't know how much his role exists at Reason, but my God, do I hate their spin on stuff. And I find even him on interviews, it's a little bit of it's a little bit of like that Weasley trick of, hey, so when you were out there being a pedophile, it's like, well, wait a second, where did that come from? And so they kind of put, they did that with the Meekhawks a little bit, where they were like posing these questions where the framing was just already heavily dictated with his own spin.
What's the Meekhawks? What's that?
So that was the Mises Caucus kind of overtook the Libertarian Party. Let's not get too in the weeds.
No,
let's preach the greatness of the finer libertarians out there. I think it was a thrill for me and Dave that we experienced as we were digesting the COVID information and calling it out for all the lies and the data manipulation that we were seeing. Nearly everyone in our social circle, firstly, we found that the people in the Liberty movement were so thankful for the fact that we were seeing it the same way that they were. And that not only were we just talking to, I mean, it was incredible proof of all of the ideas of Liberty, in that if you had just taken a pro-freedom approach and that government shouldn't be able to have centralized expanded authority to make health decisions for you, let's say you just took a pro-freedom approach without delving into any of the science, you would have gotten it right. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? It's like, it happens to be that COVID probably became the greatest example for why government shouldn't be able to take emergency authority. Because look at how spectacularly they failed and how spectacularly they basically lied about data in order to, I don't know, at best, you know, push pharmaceutical profits. Yeah. But I'm just saying, without going too far down the rabbit hole of the specifics of everything they got wrong with COVID, which was literally everything, all the way down from natural immunity to mass working to whether or not a vaccine was going to be a good idea. There's no detail about it that they got right. But if you just started it with a libertarian perspective of government shouldn't be able to take this authority and you should be able to make your own decisions, you were right from the beginning.
Yeah.
And so it was interesting. So Reason doesn't speak for me. It wasn't my introduction to Liberty. It's not even something that I look at other than sometimes things come across my radar that are so unbelievably bad. Me and Dave go, okay, we have to address this on the show.
Yeah.
But of all the new media of libertarianisms, which are, you know, your Tom Woods, your Scott Hordens, Gene Epstein's, like literally all the people that are across my feed, the Brownstone Institute did a particularly good job. I think Jeffrey Tucker is the guy's name. He's always wearing the bow tie.
Yeah.
He did a great job on it. So everything that was coming across my radar from the Liberty world was, oh, these other people are seeing it the same way I am. And then once we started getting into the weeds of the information that was being put out as, hey, this is 100% science. And, you know, the autist brain's kind of going to work and going, well, that's not the way statistics work, or, you know, that's being misrepresented. So I think overwhelmingly the new school of Liberty media did an incredibly good job with COVID. And I think we had the leg up of just having a pro-freedom approach, which was validated by everything that happened with COVID.
Yeah.
But Reason or some of those old school, more traditional things, which I think are just some Koch brother money pretending to be a different division of the right wing to just kind of reinforce that certain things are supposed to be absolute norms. I don't, to me, they don't speak for Liberty.
Yeah. And maybe I'll have, you know, some of those Reason guys on, or, you know, they invite me to their kind of meetups and things, and I haven't seen them in a while. But, you know, maybe I'll ask some of the Reason guys. I would love to ask them, because I would bet, like a lot of people, they say, no, we were right on it. We were very skeptical or whatever. But to me, I turn to the people I turn to in times of darkness. I would go onto their site, and anything short of biggest human rights abuse in U.S. history was going to be disappointing to me. And yet it was much worse than that. It was kind of like, you know, maybe we should only wear masks 3 days a week. You know what I mean? Like, it was like, it was inexcusable, I thought. Especially when you're turning to that.
I think that framing is brilliant. I think I think that that's really the only story that should have been told all of COVID. Biggest human rights abuse in human history. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. Well, Anyway, so this was good. We're kind of going, you know, at, to, you know, usually where I want to go around 45 minutes. So great to talk to you. We'll have to do this again, you know, get to other subjects. But, you know, it's great to talk to you.
Hell yeah, man. This was a pleasure. Anytime.
Oh, okay, good. So we'll be in touch, and you know, tell Dave I want to talk to Dave too. But I'm glad I had you on first because you know that would be the obvious choice. Like, oh, let's get Dave Smith on, you know. But if I go, maybe I go you first, and then Dave gets jealous, and he's like, "Look, I want to do Tom's podcast now."
I'm sure Dave will be the thrill to come on.
Yeah, excellent. All right, good to see you.
Excellent, thank you.
All right, I'll figure out how to shut this thing down at some point.
Top right corner, end stream.
Oh, yeah. Thanks. See you later.
I got your back, buddy.